think they're deaded.
They've been deaded, huh?
Where's Bob?
Oh, you know what?
Speaking about dead.
Where is it?
What?
Who's Bob?
There's no ta-da.
Bob was a sorry fellow who showed up at the last podcast climbing up the wall.
And we killed him. Scott did.
I just stunned him. He crawled away.
He got bin Laden'd. I just got...
What?
Will it help?
One of my earphones just went out.
It's contagious.
Who knows?
It's the headphone disease.
Let's get started before this whole thing blows up.
Exactly.
Canada and Jessica.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
This is Michael Bloom from the APS Stamp Buddy Service Committee, welcoming you to Stamp Show here today.
Stamp collecting happens when we dream together.
Welcome to Stamp Show here today, episode number 40. I'm sitting here with Scott, Cash, Steve, and Jeff, and I'm your host, Jessica. And we have a special guest today. His name is Sean. Say hi, Sean.
Hi.
Now I have to say your name, too.
Hi, my name's Sean Rapis.
There we go.
How old are you?
9.
Yay.
Cash calculated it out, and he lowers our average age in the room down to 38. Yes.
You can find us on Facebook at Stamp Show Here Today and on Twitter at Stamp Show HT. Tell your friends they can find us on iTunes, Podbay, and Stitcher. Let's talk about stamps.
Stamps. Stamps.
And always stamps. Remember, stamp collecting happens when we dream together.
Oh, I like the other one better.
Yeah.
And play in a band.
That's soon going to be famous.
So this week we'll be talking about stamp news, bringing back the lickin' stick.
Yay!
Hashtag stamp stories, hashtag a summer of stamps, hashtag albums. And our expert topic of the week is 1, 2, 3, and also number 4. So stamp news, hashtag lick it and stick it. We are declaring the acting director of stamp services, Mary Ann Penner, a friend of the stamp collector. Lynn Stamp News reports in an article entitled USPS Unable to Show Savings from Stamps Printed on Unsoakable Paper Dated July 17 of this year, written by Bill McAllister, the Washington correspondent, that the USPS cannot show any savings from strictly PSA or pressure-sensitive adhesive format.
Well, it kind of makes sense. I mean, you're taking away lickable gum, but you're still adding gum, and then you're adding another piece of paper on top of the gum. It just seemed to me that it was doomed from the beginning from a cost standpoint.
Didn't they try to claim something, though, that it was going to cost less to get different paper from some with the paper?
Well, not only that, you now have die cuts on the front, and then you have a different set of die cuts on the backing paper. So you got two different die cuts, whereas perforating process is just one pass.
One and done.
But what was it? They did say something that some of the paper or the glue or the process had to be done outside the country or something like that?
I think for PSAs, they can use a cheaper paper than they need to for lick and sticks.
It has to be a higher quality paper shipped in. It's not local.
Correct.
So they get a higher quality paper. Oh, totally off the subject. The balloon stamp is taller than the Wilt Chamberlain stamp.
Yes!
Whoa.
I knew it!
I should have saved that for Cash's corrections.
I'm not editing that.
Oh, well. Anyway. Yeah, the it just, to me, from a standpoint of paper quality, it doesn't seem like... you're adding another piece of paper. So you would have to double... the cost, or half the cost, double the cost on the new one, half the cost on the old one, for it to make economic sense, because you're adding another piece of paper to
I don't think you're actually doubling the cost, but I think the production process in making paper with a self-adhesive backing already on it before it goes through the print process would be that just that paper would be more expensive than the paper with lick and stick gum.
So I like Scott's argument that he stated when he first heard this article about maybe we should make certain types of stamps.
Yeah, I was thinking that stamps that are targeted for collect, since collectors like or prefer the to collect the lick and stick type stamps, why not make all commemoratives lick and stick and use the self-adhesive for the workhorse definitive stamps that they print by the billions anyway? And
so you have a Fern lick and stick, but Elvis is a
Elvis backwards. Would be
a
stick
backwards. Elvis is a lick and stick, and the ferns
and the flags and all of that stuff would be
so people can put a million of them on the envelopes, you know,
right? And and you know, your Express Mail and your Priority Mail stamps would still be self-adhesive because they're definitive stamps. But even though they aren't printed in the quantities that the first class rate stamps are.
Already the exceptions in the second sentence.
Yeah.
But, I mean, but they're definitive stamps. They're not commemorative stamps, so.
Nobody collects ferns.
Well, she also, she's looking at the numbers, and that's kind of impressive because there was also some things about inside of the next article. Next week, where she was talking about not closing some places and closing other places. And I mean, she's actually looking at the numbers instead of just saying, oh, yeah, it saves us money. Let's keep doing this. So from a making a profit standpoint, you know, it's she's on the right track.
Well, it's funny because the way that they got this information is they had to use the Freedom of Information Act. And then they actually redacted the numbers that were in there so we wouldn't know the real percentages. And it's like, really? This isn't spy documents from like North Korea or something. They're going to redact post
office
documents.
Well, maybe that special paper comes from North Korea.
That's possible.
That's it, yeah.
Jeans from there are worth a lot of money, actually.
Oh, yeah.
And somebody's political favor being covered up.
Jessica's shaking her head. You just can't hear it.
You can show your support personally by writing her at USPS, care of Mary Ann Penner, 475 L'ENFANT Plaza, SW, Washington, D.C., District of Columbia, zip code 20260. And she also has a LinkedIn profile for all of you that are savvy on LinkedIn. And you can also tweet at the post office. And she also is part of that social media movement. So show your support. Let's bring back the lick and stick.
Woo!
Go lick and stick.
Yay! Yay.
Hashtag Stamp Stories, our summer fun series. So this week I want to talk about albums. So we all have to start somewhere when it comes to putting our newfound treasures in a stamp album. Where did you guys start?
I started in a Minuteman album.
I started, and I'm going to let everybody know how old I am here now. My first stamp album was a clearance sale from the Akron in Southern California, which I think went out of business in like 1965 or something.
Man, you're old.
I know it.
And mine was a Harris Washington Monument album purchased from the Thrifties for 89 cents back in 1963. 64, actually.
You paid 64. 9 times more than I did.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, but mine was new.
Mine was new. Mine even came with a little bag of stamps or a glassine full of stamps, like but the most common stamps you've ever seen. I mean, after 55 years, they're still valueless. Well,
I had the pleasures of my brothers having to share with me, and they gave me the presidential stickers that went in the front of the album.
Ooh.
But that was why I'm OCD today, because I told them I would show them.
It's COD. Or it's CDO.
Only if you're paying me, it's COD.
No, it's CDO. CDO is OCD in alphabetical order, the way it should be.
Cute.
Which alphabet?
The Cyrillic one.
Okay.
No, I remember because the first, my little 10-cent album showed U.S. number one, U.S. number two. And then the next stamp was a 3-cent banknote. So it went to like number 136, and I didn't have to monkey with anything in between.
Ooh.
Okay, so that's what you started with. What do you guys recommend now?
Banker
boxes.
Storage units.
No,
<please. laughs> I can't top that. I can look at it for you, though.
Oh, boy. So, joking aside, what are your preferred albums?
No, that was the truth.
That was the truth, but straightforward. As far as albums, I prefer the ones that you print on demand from Stamp Albums.
Wait a minute.
I actually keep my stuff in a box because most of it's certified, so it has little folders. And if it doesn't go in there, realistically, I don't have an album. I have my exhibit. I mount everything on exhibit pages.
Vario stock pages are wonderful.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I use stock pages, stock books, the print-on-demand albums. I actually design a lot of my own album pages.
But as far as albums go, what was your past favorite? Like, was it a Scott specialty album, or was it a Hingeless album, maybe from Lighthouse? Or
I really have only had two albums. I had the Minuteman. I started collecting U.S. used, and then I got a National album to collect U.S. Mint. And those are the only two albums I've ever had.
The standard was the Scott's National.
The Scott National, yeah.
However, if you're not into cutting and fixing mounts to the page, or if that's then you should get a Hingeless album.
Well, I am a big fan of Mystic's Hingeless line.
That's what I was going to bring up.
There was an Heirloom album.
This is a new line that they created. It's Hingeless,
right?
I actually called them up and asked if I could do a review, and they sent me an album, no charge. I reviewed the album, and I really, really liked the album.
That's the one with, it's about the Aethic Maroon binding, and it has like ridges on the spine.
Yeah, we've given him, I'll bet you we've given him five or six plugs here on the podcast, because I like it, too. I think it's a they did a fantastic
for the quality.
It's like $120 bucks or something like that.
The price is super reasonable.
I agree with it. I've seen it. I bought a collection over a year ago.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
Absolutely. Well laid out with the stamp stories with them.
That would be, I think if I was going to collect U.S., that would be my preferred go-to between quality and price. I don't think you can beat it at this time.
I agree.
The only problem is they have trouble keeping them in stock.
Oh, they did too good of a job.
They did. They did a really good job.
Okay, well, tell us how you collect your stamps and what album on Twitter. Hashtag Stamp Stories, hashtag A Summer of Stamps, hashtag Albums. So, updates. Kaj, talk to us.
I really only have one update.
You mean that the balloon stamp is taller than Wilt Chamberlain?
Yeah, I know. I should have. Okay, the balloon stamp is taller than the Wilt Chamberlain stamp.
Well, so is the desert cactus stamp, which is the same size as the balloon stamp.
Yeah, but the balloon stamp looks neater. And I couldn't find one of the desert cactuses. So.
They're the same size.
I know. I figured.
You didn't ask Steve to bring one along today.
But the other one is there was a 476A on eBay. Without a certificate.
Then it can't be a 476A.
And people who, it still went for $1,800.
Wow. Cute. Back to that sucker comment earlier.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Was it sold by the guy that did those $7 million worth of lots?
No. I still, thank you, P.T. Barnum. I'm following that one up. Those lots actually sold. So, you know, somebody out there bought $4 million worth of stamps for $700 bucks, or is standing by their post office box.
Crying.
Waiting for him to show up.
That's a pretty good return.
As we said at the beginning of the program, dreaming
Yes.
Stamp collecting happens when we dream together.
Oh, Scott, you know it from memory now.
So anyway, the 476A is a stamp without a watermark. It notoriously has a very light watermark. It's questionable whether it even exists, but if it doesn't have a PF cert, it isn't it, and somebody way overpaid for an incorrect stamp because they just didn't know what they...
But that's all conjecture now, even with the PF, considering they do have a VSC machine now, too.
Well, I haven't seen a new PF cert on a number 476A.
But if they do, wouldn't they be more likely to be overturning their original opinions with the capabilities of and the results?
I don't know if they're
VSC?
Willing to go there yet.
They've issued some
based
sort
upon
of
an article. No.
Yeah, didn't that article say they released some sort of statement saying, oh, they're in 2014, that there's a possibility that that might not be entirely correct along those lines?
Sure, from a liability standpoint, that was well put. But and they're not liable. However, it does make them look good in the light, but they have to acquiesce to new technology.
All I have to say to that is technology advances over time, and we know things now that we didn't know. Many
years ago.
My dean,
absolutely. Yeah.
20, 30, 50 years ago. We can see things. We can determine different things. And so these...
Bottom line is, yes, that was my DNA on that stamp.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Here's technology.
They made a call based on what they saw with the equipment they had at the time.
Correct.
Here's technology.
And you can't do any better than that.
Except rescind.
Hey, I'm trying to talk here.
If technology proves otherwise.
I have a useless fact I want to contribute.
Cash is trying to interrupt here. Give him a minute.
Jeez.
Well, you know, it's not often we get to keep Cash from talking.
In 1960, it took 63 days for a chicken to get to 4 pounds. Today, it takes 47 days to get it to 5 pounds.
How did I know it was about chickens? I just purchased
on eBay, and I want to thank Victory Stamps. Victoria Radin is the person who shipped it to me. I got a really interesting looking, way, way under inked chicken stamp.
Ooh, nice.
It looks like smeary, and it's one that, you know, somebody should not have let out. It's definitely
on it.
It would have been like printer's waste or something. Oh,
close
it's got
to it.
It's got full perfect original gums, so I know it's not just faded or anything like that.
Okay.
But it looks terribly faded, dry printed, ugly, and that goes in my chicken collection.
Cool.
Okay, so I'm going to read some listener mail we got. It's a little long, but it's worth a good read.
You mean we're off the 476A?
Yes.
For now. Someone bought into something may or may not exist.
Pretty much.
Okay, it's from Marcel Sleeker. And he says, hello, everyone. I'm checking the latest episode, and I'm actually from the Netherlands.
Yay, number two.
Yeah, being the second biggest listening country. How awesome. I collect predominantly U.S. material. Besides that, of course, the Netherlands and a few topicals for now. I have a question. How can I get a Philatelic Book of Secrets copy? And the answer is...
it's on its way if we have your address.
Yep.
Send us your address. And I'm sure we'll get his address after I post this. So.
My compliments.
Yeah. So my second question is, I used a pressure machine to look for watermarks. Is that wise, or should I always go for liquids?
Well, in that respect, I think having more than one option to look for a watermark is always a plus.
Well, first of all, why don't you describe what a pressure machine is?
A pressure machine is probably...
Cygnoscope.
A cygnoscope or a roll detector.
Morley Bright
detector. Those are all pressure devices. The Morley Bright and the roll detector use a packet of dark-colored ink in a thick plastic pouch, and you press it, and it detects the watermark, which is a thinner area in the paper. The cygnoscope uses light at an extreme oblique angle to shine it across. It flattens out the stamp, and then it shines the light across the stamp, and in the same way, it detects the shadows where the paper is thinner. So they both are non-wetting types, although the Cynoscope tends not to work as well with stamps that have gum on them because the gum tends to fill in the watermarks.
So but it's non-conclusive.
It can be, unless it's a strong watermark. But the Morley Bright and the Rolodetector can be good. I like the watermark fluid better.
Me too. After all the years of trying Cygnoscope and Morley Brights, I don't have the right finesse to do the Morley Bright and the Cygnoscope. Well, there's one little crucial piece of equipment that when I bought my Cygnoscope was not included, thus our results were non-conclusive, and that was the little piece of thin little paper, the tissue paper, like, yeah, it's not tissue paper.
It's plastic.
It's plastic now, but before it was a paper.
Yeah.
And I didn't get that little packet, so my results were not good.
I didn't get it when I bought mine either, but I have since acquired some. But I still get good results even without it. I get better results with it.
With fluid.
With the paper in the I'm just talking the Cynoscope now.
Okay,
I get good results without it. I get better results with it.
Don't use it anymore because I was too frustrated with it. And
that's usually my second go to
for confirmation of
for confirmation.
A difficult item.
Yes, usually.
Okay. Steve, I think you had the best advice when Jeff asked you about this.
You remember that? I was having a hard time with the watermark.
And I said,
you told me to skip all the machines, and you told me to put several drops of Ronsonol on the card first, hold the stamp upside down, face down, directly over it, and let go of it. And it fills in a couple of seconds. The first couple of seconds it's in there, you see the watermark the best.
That's correct.
And I was able to successfully identify a hard stamp because of that.
Right.
So,
okay.
Thank you.
And again, if you're inconclusive or not sure, make sure you let it dry thoroughly, not for a few seconds, but a couple minutes, and then change your conditions to under a brighter light or over by a window. But key is fluid in the bottom of the tray, and you're dropping it with the back or the reverse to you, and be prepared to look at it almost immediately because that's when it pops and is most evident.
Okay, there's one more question. He says, my last question is, my next step for my Devo albums are the U.S. Zeppelins. What do I look for if I want to avoid fake ones?
Well, really the only forgery you have to worry about is on the high value.
I'll disagree because I actually got a middle value that was fake too. But
the only forgery that is not easy to detect.
And that's
detect.
A postal forgery. If you got that, you actually, I think, win.
Yes.
What?
Yes, yeah, it's worth more.
It's worth at least as much as the genuine item. So there aren't very many forged Zeppelins for the U.S. out there.
No, there's not.
They are very rare. They're very collectible. If you find one, and, I mean, even if you pay for a genuine one, you get a fake one, you're really not missing the mark too far as far as value goes anyway. You just have to replace it with a genuine one for your collection. Now you have a fake to go with it, which
I wouldn't worry too much. I've only seen a couple of them in my 40 plus years of dealing. They're not that prevalent.
No, they're not. Not
and
at
actually
all.
The way to tell the fakes, not the postal forgery, but the fakes that are out there to defraud the collectors, is look at the frame lines. The frame lines won't be continuous. They'll have like breaks in them. It won't be a really nice frame line around the stamp.
And once again, if you have concern about authenticity or condition, this is the reason, again, to have your stamps either purchased with a cert at the time you buy the stamps or on the condition that you can get them certified. And that way, that protects you. If you're worried, buy a certed stamp already.
Yeah, because I see reperfs and regums more than anything with those guys.
And yeah, real concern.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Even though that's not very prevalent either, it is much more prevalent than fakes.
I bet you know, on Zeppelins, the number one thing that you want to watch out for is people selling hinged ones is never hinged.
Yeah. Sometimes
that's the big thing to watch out for.
Sometimes the hinging is very light, or sometimes it's been brushed out. They take a little damp brush and they brush over where the hinge mark is to kind of smooth out the gum and make it appear never hinged. And those, that's what you really have to watch out for the most.
The Zeppelins you need to watch out for as far as fakes, reprints, or forgeries are the German Zepps. I have seen thousands of sets.
Sheets of them.
Sheets, that, yeah. Literal, but yeah. Broken down in singles. I have seen thousands of sets of them. And long before the ones of recent years, in the last 10 years, there's a lot of them came out. But in the 70s, there were lithographs then that were, they weren't prevalent, but I was aware of them and they existed in lots or collections. And there you have to go and be careful. But
yeah,
not,
if you
not
have
for the U.S.
German
Zepps,
you really need a CERC. You absolutely have to have one.
Okay.
Did not know that.
And he also complimented us. He says, I love the show. Listened to all the episodes a few weeks back in one weekend when I discovered you guys, and I've learned so much. Our former queen also had a different birthday. And that was all. Thanks for the podcast. It's really awesome. Kind regards, Marcel Sleeker.
Wow. Thank you, Marcel. That means thank he you. Binged us 40 hours of us talking almost.
Cash is bad joke.
I can't even take that.
And some good ones.
Well done, that's sir. Thank you.
Okay. And real quick, for those of you that don't know, Cash is a professional magician. So I got him exactly 52 cards. If there's one more in here, I apologize because it says 52 cards.
Oh,
from they're glow in the dark.
54 because there's two jokers.
No, it says 52 all over the box.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah. It's from the Haunted Mansion. I assume Disney. Yeah, Disney Park Haunted Mansion. That's cool.
They do a really cool thing where it's a clear acrylic card and it's just opaque where the actual values
I don't
are.
I think those ones.
Oh, that's neat.
I thought they were.
Thank you very much.
It's supposed to be old school.
Subject to next week's program.
Yeah, he'll do a visual magic trick on a podcast.
Well, wasn't our premise of this show to dream?
Yeah. There you go.
Well, your card's the Eight of Hearts.
Well, you remember...
I see it right now.
Everybody out there, get a deck of cards, cut it to a random card in the middle, and it is the Jack of Spades.
I was going to say that...
But you're not doing the trick.
Now, 51 of you out there are going to go, no, it's not. But that 52nd person, he's going to go, wow, how did he do that?
Okay, so
I'll take those odds.
Okay, so our expert topic of the week is the first Bureau issue, 1, 2, 3, 4.
It's not the Bureau issue.
Oh, no. Burn. What is it?
It's the first.
The first.
National.
Yeah. Okay. Well, first general issue of the United States. Because they're the first actual stamp from the United States is number 40L1 that was issued in New York City.
Wow.
And
Franklin.
Yes.
Washington.
Oh, you are right. It is Washington.
A gray Washington stamp from New York.
Yes.
And it comes on two different kinds of paper.
I think it actually comes on several different kinds of paper.
The major one is rose paper and regular wove paper, is it, right?
Yep.
Woven rose or roven woes.
Okay, so this was a historical first issue, and it's not a Bureau issue. Why did the U.S. see the need for stamps?
Because, like the rest of the world, they wanted to get paid up front for the stamp or for the letter being delivered. You used to send everything COD, pretty much. Rarely, and the reason is because of the way that the mail was done. And we're talking like the 14s and 1500s. Your letters got lost a lot. So you didn't want to pay if your letter got lost. Second thing is, people didn't always exist where you thought they were going to be existing at. So what would happen is you would mail a letter, and if it was a 23-cent rate, which is what it was back in the 1815 range, the War of 1812 rate. And their rates were wild. They went all over the place. But you sent a letter to a person, and if he got it, he would pay the postman. and he'd say, here you go, thank you very much. And it would be a rather expensive chunk of change.
Yeah.
You know, like $20 equivalent today to get a letter. So, you know, they'd get it and they'd say, oh, thank you, that's from my mother-in-law. Yes, I'll give you your $20.
Oh, no, no, no. If it's from your mother-in-law, you send it back.
Or, yeah, exactly like you
said. I no longer want this.
Yeah, I do not want to pay you $20. And now the postman has this letter that trucked, you know, some monstrously huge distance,
63
like
20, miles.
Yeah, like 55 miles from the next county. And all of a sudden he gets paid nothing for it.
Well, crap.
So they said,
well, no,
we want you guys paying up front. We're going to lower the price to a nickel, which was the equivalent of about $4, maybe a little bit more than $4. But it was the equivalent of $4 given that everybody in the country pretty much made minimum wage. So it took you about 30 minutes to earn enough money to send a letter.
So I like your theories behind how we ended up with our first postmaster.
Oh, yeah. I love Benjamin Franklin. He's great. But he wasn't the first. Well, he was the first postmaster of a place called the United States. But he wasn't really the first postmaster. He was, first of all, he was a joint postmaster. But again, we were talking about the postmaster today. He is him and his partner, whose name was Hunter. I forget his first name. Oh, William Hunter. They made the colonial post office profitable for the first time ever.
And last time?
And the last time, yeah. Well, see, that's why I said he became the postmaster for the quote-unquote United States in 1774. Well, the problem is that there wasn't a United States in 1774. He was established by the Continental Congress. Later on, he found some subversive mail from the British to a governor, I believe it was. And if I'm not going to bother issuing a casual correction if I'm wrong, but I think it was a governor. And he opened the mail and gave it to the newspapers. And the newspapers took it off because it said something like, you know, hey, really crank down on these colonial guys. You know, we really have to show them who's boss. So Benjamin Franklin, they found out that Benjamin Franklin is the one who basically stole the letter and gave it to the newspapers, and he got fired. So he was fired from the British post office, and then immediately, you know, a little while later, hired by the colonial post office. And then, of course, when he resigned from that very quickly because he became a founding father as opposed to a postmaster general.
What year was that, like 1731 or something like that?
I have it written right here. He started as the assistant postmaster in 1737.
That's close.
And he became an actual postmaster in 1753. And again, he was one of two, with William Hunter being the other one.
Well, so that's how he ended up on the first stamp?
That was why he ended up on the first stamp. Well, in addition to that, him and George Washington at the time period, and I love colonial history, these guys were true superstars. They were, you know, Brad Pitt times 10.
Whoa.
You know,
I don't think the women saw it that way.
These guys were it. And like in France, when he wore his coonskin cap to show that he was like one of these American outwoodsy guys.
You're talking about Franklin now.
Franklin, yeah. He never wore a coonskin cap. Well, maybe he did as a joke or something.
Here, pull my tail.
Yeah. He went to France, and he was just the promotional arm of the U.S. government, and he was fantastic at it. And George Washington was the same thing, except he was here in the United States that way, and they could do no wrong until Washington's second term in office, in which everybody started criticizing him of stuff because, you know, after 4 years of being president, they realized he was a normal guy. But these guys were the superstars. And that's why they're on the first two stamps.
Who was even the vice president at the time?
Under Washington. George Washington?
Yeah.
John Adams.
John Adams.
Yeah. Oh, he was pretty big stuff, too.
He
But he wasn't stamp material?
Not at that time. He grew into it.
And then he wasn't, well, he was a Federalist.
He passed the Alien Sedition Acts, you know, stuff like that, which is a big blotch on.
Yeah, but he wasn't put on a stamp till what, 38?
Yeah, when was his first stamp? Yeah.
1938, 2 cent.
Hamilton, or excuse me, Jefferson, he was like the next one, right?
On the 38 presidentials? Yeah.
No. The next one to appear on a stamp. You had Washington and Franklin for a very long period, and then Jefferson poked up on the 5 center, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ah.
And then after that, you had Jackson, who was ultra cool.
Because he came.
And then you had Lincoln because he was really good at catching bullets.
A new slant.
So why is the 10 cent so much rarer today than the 5 cent?
Quantities issued?
Yeah, pretty much.
I'm sorry.
Two-word answer.
Well, the...
wasn't that much demand for their use?
We're talking about, and again, this is my time period. I love this time period. This was the 1840s, 1850s. Everything was local.
Yeah, and you have to remember that traveling, the 5 cent rate was up to 300 miles.
Yeah.
And most people didn't know anybody that lived more than 300 miles away. Why would you ever send them a letter?
Yeah, not only that, but 300 miles was a trek. And again, this is before the 1847 issue, but if you go back into like the 1830s, if you mailed a letter from New York to Ohio, there were no roads that went from New York to Ohio, and there were a bunch of mountains in the way. If you wanted a letter from New York to Ohio, you put it on a ship. It went down around Florida to Louisiana, got on a boat, and went up the Mississippi River to Ohio.
Yikes.
So, you know, there was a, and since everything was local, that's why the 5 cent stamp is much more common, is it was a 5 cent rate for 300 miles, and it was a 10 cent rate over 300 miles. And you just didn't know that many people over 300 miles.
So you think the 10 cent was mainly used for, like, diplomatic purposes?
No, it was used transcontinental.
For transcontinental, things that were going over to San Francisco from the East Coast. No,
that was a different rate even.
Well, yeah, that was over 3,000 miles.
Yeah, that was a big rate.
But if you were going from New York to Chicago, that would be a 10 cent rate. 10 cents would have been a double rate if your letter was too heavy. Yeah. That's what the 10 cent
I think that
was for.
New York to Virginia was more than 300 miles. Because, again, it's not 300 miles as the crow flies. It's 300 miles via the postal routes.
Good point.
Yeah, and if the postal route, let's say the postal route from New York to Chicago included going to Florida.
Yeah.
I mean, that would count as distance added to the route that your letter would travel and therefore would determine the postal rate.
Well, there's one of my favorite TV shows is How the States Got Their Shapes, and it's on History Channel, and it shows this little notch in the top of Massachusetts. Massachusetts's west border isn't straight. It's got a little notch out of it, and that's because it's behind a bunch of mountains. So they gave that little notch to New York, saying, you know, we cannot get to that little notch. And so you had all these robbers and everything going there and saying, aha, you can't get me. I'm in Massachusetts. And the Massachusetts guys would go, aha, oh, we can't get there. There's mountains in the way.
Oops.
So, you know, you had these really wild little things where people just didn't move. And that's why 300 miles was really the limit.
So what's the biggest difference in design and how do you tell them apart?
Well, first of all, I mean, I assume you're talking about 3 and 4 versus 1 and 2.
Correct.
Yeah.
First of all, you have to understand that the 1 and 2, when they were printed, they were printed by a private firm, not by the government. And there wasn't a whole lot of, they were supposed to turn the plates over to the government after the contract. And those plates were lost. And so when the Centennial Exhibition came around, they wanted to have all of the U.S. stamps on sale. So in 1875, they made new plates and reissued the stamps, even though they were not valid for postage because it was after the Civil War and 1 and 2 had been demonetized at the beginning of the Civil War. But they wanted to have them on sale for exposition goers if they wanted to buy them. And that's how 3 and 4 came into being. And they're from new plates. So there are small design differences that are detailed in the catalog. And so, they were also issued without gum.
So that raises another question. If they were made from new plates many years after the fact with other designs having occurred in between, considering the Civil War, why did they get the designation of 3 and 4 and not something further down the line more logically?
Well, at one time, the Scott catalog had special printings in the back with proofs and essays, and they made the decision to put them in the front of the catalog near where the similar appearing stamps were to go. And it was just an editorial change that they made.
When did they do that? In the late 20s, I thought it was, right?
I think they've moved them around a couple times, I think.
I think it was in the 30s because I think it was through the 30s that they were still assigning the numbers just numerically.
Yeah.
And the revenues have earlier numbers than some commemoratives and vice versa. So I think it was in the mid-30s.
Yeah, so number 1 and 2 were issued in 1847. Number 3 and 4 were issued in 1875. Number 5 and 6 and 7 and 8 and all those were issued in 1851. So they are not chronological. Yeah.
Right.
It's editor's discretion.
Yeah.
That was that editor's legacy.
But if they're in the proof and essay section, then they generally wouldn't appear in stamp albums and people didn't collect them and didn't seek them out and they just kind of languished and their value is much lower. And the editors got enough pressure from whatever sector of the hobby to move them back into the regular postage listings and restore those old numbers. And therefore, now they're a lot of times in higher end albums, there actually are spaces for those stamps to be collected.
So, how were they made? How were the first stamps made? Were they made differently?
No, it's actually.
No, they're engraved.
Yeah, they're engraved, but it's interesting.
The original ones, they surmise, they don't know for sure, that they were made on engraved copper plates.
Mm-hmm. Something that wasn't hardened.
Right, not hardened. Huh. And as a result, the brown ink, being extremely abrasive, wore the design. And you can see the later printings tend to have mushy, distinct designs.
These were banknote companies. And a banknote company would get an order.
Well, Toppin & Carpenter wasn't a bank.
Yeah, they were
a banknote company.
And you'd get an order from a bank for about 25,000 impressions. However many, so if there were 10 items. But you'd get about 25,000 impressions. Then they'd clean the plates and try to make about 20,000 more. So you get about 45,000 impressions. And then U.S. number 1 comes along and doesn't get 45,000 impressions. They get 175,000 impressions. And so you can picture what, at the end, these plates look like. And the stamps in the later, in the 1851 period, they have no detail to them. I mean, they're just like little smeary little stamps covered with a lot of blank spots.
Mushy looking.
Very mushy looking.
Muddy. I have seen those, and now that makes sense.
Yeah, muddy.
So if it's too crisp or clean, it's probably too good to be true.
Well, no, the first ones would have been clean, wouldn't they, from the first run? Yeah.
They just look more like the proofs. I can show those to you. I'll hold them up. I have them with me.
Yeah. Now the closer to the microphone.
Yeah. I have proofs of number 1 and 2 with me, and I have the mint block of 6 with me.
Yep.
Now the number.
Hold it up to the microphone.
Number 3 and 2 were printed in 1875. They were made from new plates, but they were also made in much smaller quantities. So the impressions on 3 and 4 are always nice and crisp and clean. And the 1 cent, or the 5 cent, number 3, has a distinctive color that really isn't found too often on the number 1. And so 99% of them, of the time, you can just look at the stamp and say, yeah, this is a number 3. Number 4 is a little bit harder. You have to rely on the design tells to
But the paper's different, too.
The paper's slightly different. Now, the paper that they printed on is interesting. It's not just white paper. It's bluish paper, and the paper actually has tiny crystals of lazurite embedded in the paper to give it the bluish color.
It looks really cool under magnification.
You look at it under 15-20 power magnification, and you can actually see the individual crystals in the paper weave.
Wow. Now, this is the stamp we've seen the most photocopies of.
Yeah, here
in
the office.
And so that paper is a lot thicker. You know, modern paper is probably thicker than the original, isn't it?
Well, if you're photocopying it, you can also tell that it's not engraved. You can tell the paper is white. You can,
especially if it has pixels.
Yeah, you've got pixelation involved.
We get those. We really do.
Or inkjet splatter.
Yeah.
Well, the interesting one, and this was over...
Keep on sending those bad copies. We take a fee for them.
Yeah. Paraguay. Put out a souvenir sheet of U.S. number one and number two, and people cut out the number twos and say, "Ah, look what I got!" And but again, they're slightly different; they don't look the same. And if you really want to do that, take the 1847 souvenir sheet, and you can have a U.S. number one and number two, and the number one will be blue, and the number two will be light brown, and you can put those in your album and. Have a nice day.
Yep. Hey, we had a listener ask a question about those, so yep. It happens.
Now, there are proofs, plate proofs of one and two as well, and specimens, actually. So, and they come on card and on India paper, and they're kind of neat when you see them.
Yeah, that's a good question. Number one and number two were the ones that were issued. Number three and number four were the souvenir sheets. Shouldn't number five be the 1947 souvenir sheet?
That's what I thought.
Well, by then they'd already reordered the catalog.
Ah, well.
Let's annoy the crap out of every collector out there and demand that Scott catalog puts it where it should go.
Yeah.
Once again, it's editor's choice.
Yeah.
So who designed these first stamps?
Toppin and Carpenter, was it?
No.
Rowan and Martin?
I forget their names. It wasn't Toppin and Carpenter.
Rodden, Hatch, and Toppin.
There it is.
Rodden, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow, you guys got that off the top of your head. Good job.
Well, it took three of us.
We had to dig.
And it wasn't Franklin.
Nope.
No, Franklin just gets the credit.
Franklin was dead by then, so was Washington, obviously.
I don't know. Elvis is in the building.
Yeah, well, Elvis is still alive.
Yeah.
It could have been zombie Washington. You never know.
Ah, there you go.
Or Abraham
Lincoln
zombie.
Well, you'd have to check his teeth.
Man. All right. Well, they look like zombie teeth when they were alive. I mean...
Okay, that about wraps it up, I guess. Do you guys have anything else you want to add?
Well, I noticed you have this other listener question down there, and I thought it was...
That's really for next time.
Where's your C3 sheet?
Oh, we'll get to that.
Oh, you said, well, I thought you were saying this was the end of it.
What's the other question that's missing?
Where's the C3 sheet?
Oh. While Cash is getting that, sorry if you heard office noise in the background. It's the end of July, we're hot, and we had to leave the door open. That and Sean likes to move around in his chair a lot. Yeah, I'm looking at you.
And I caught him playing with the cord. I said, that was my job.
Okay, here we go. A C3A sheet. These came from...
La Habra Post Office.
No. These came from, what, St. Louis?
The Fulfillment Center.
So if they like me, they might have put one in here. And...
Aww.
Normal...
Is that another $10 of postage?
Yeah. No, this time it's $12 of postage. Okay.
It's worth all $12 if you use it.
Yeah.
Or more or less, depending on circumstances.
Okay, you can email us at stampshowtoday@gmail.com, Twitter at stampshowht, Facebook at stampshowtoday, and our website www.stampshowtoday.com with your questions and comments. We will read them on the air. You can now leave your questions and comments on a Google Voice answering machine anytime, country code 1-949-873-4298. There's also a link to our Google Voice on our website so you can make the call from your computer. And on that note, Keep collecting.
Hi, this is Tom Mills, H.R. Harmer Stamp Auctions. You're listening to the podcast for a Stamp Show Here Today.
Hi, this is Stephen Patillo, also known as Stamp Show Steve. I'm sitting here in the offices of PSE, Professional Stamp Experts, and I'd like to say hi and welcome you all to come to the various stamp shows once a month in Glendale, Van Nuys, and Anaheim. You can find all these dates, locations, and maps at stampshowsteve.com, and we welcome you to bring your stamps in to sell or buy or trade. There's multiple dealers there to help you fill in your collection or to buy what you may have for them. I hope that you all can sometime venture out and come to one of our shows, look it up on our website, and come. And if you have stamps for authentication purposes or grading purposes, seek out myself or the table that represents PSE Professional Stamp Experts.
This episode of Stamp Show Here Today is brought to you by the Philatelic Book of Secrets, the book that teaches you about repurfs, regums, color varieties, and much more. Get yours for $10 at www.philatelicsecrets.com today.
Return to sender.